Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, an online study group for students of the Urantia book and anyone who might be interested in the teachings of the fifth epical revelation. I'm Andrea Barnes, and I'm here with my three co-hosts, Dr. Chris Halverson, Kermit Anderson, and filling in tonight for Brad Garner, we have Justin Armstrong. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Well, good evening, Andrea. Thank you for taking the MC duties up front there. And thank you, Justin, for stepping in on short notice. And great to have you with us, as always, Kermit. And everyone listening, welcome to you all.
Thank you. Justin, how are you doing this evening? Thanks for being here.
Hi, Andrea. I'm well. I'm really actually excited to be here. I always learn so much studying Dr. Chris and you guys. And, yeah, just really happy to be here.
We're really glad to have you as well. And Kermit, how about you? How's things going up there in the northwest?
Doing well, enjoying the full force of spring and enjoying the daylight at showtime. Last week, our post-review discussion was wide-ranging with several focal points. Righteousness was again a main topic. Symmetry of Soul suggested a model of righteousness, conformity with the cosmos, as being a conductor in a cosmic circuitry as opposed to a resistor. The primary notions of the primitive notions of righteousness encountered in early religious practices should be seen as evidence of a pre-existing genuine righteousness as a cosmic value to be recognized and appreciated in concert with the love of God. The admonition found in the fifth epical revelation concerning first and second milers in paper 195, section 10, should be a clue as to the need for a righteousness renewal. Be ye perfect, even as I am perfect, is the opening theme of the revelation and reiterated throughout, framed variously as a command, a mandate, injunction, calling, present goal of the super universe, admonishment, and eternal urge. The good news of God's absolute and infinite love for each of his children is the foundational initiating recognition for the creature's response to the divine injunction. Overemphasis on God's love while being deaf to God's call to righteousness leads to declarations of liberty, falsely so called, ultimately leading to darkness and death. The gospel of all you need is love is the first step along that path. We began our reading in a new paper, paper 138, Training the Kingdom's Messengers. Jesus called his six apostles together in preparation for their visits two by two about the Sea of Galilee. His failure to include his brothers James and Jude with the six and their subsequent hurt feelings provided opportunity to reflect on the fact that Jesus many times was seemingly aloof and apparently lacking in sympathy with his family, apostles, and followers. Jesus did not conduct himself according to the established standards of social usage. Only by judging his behavior in consonance with the highest spiritual ideals can we begin to find a correct understanding of this God-man. Could not his apparent coldness allow those near him an opportunity to struggle with their conflicting emotions and motives and mobilize increased measures of faith to surmount such difficulties? As it was, we are told his family nearly rejected him, only finding resolution after his death and resurrection. Even so, the authors assure us that he did everything humanly consistent with doing the Father's will to retain the confidence and affection of his family. Section 1, Final Instructions. The six apostles were assigned in pairs to spend 2 weeks about the Sea of Galilee. Their instructions were to do only personal work. They were to do no public preaching. Somewhat disappointed, the six embarked on their mission in good heart and with confident enthusiasm. prior to sending out the six, Jesus announced that each of the six were to choose one man from the early converts to become apostles with them. Note, Jesus did not personally manage the selection of the remaining six apostles. As representative of the Father, he initiated and did not micromanage the outworking of the apostolic organization. We are reminded that Jesus was not immune from the temptation to use his potential powers to effect the Baptist's release from prison, but his recent experience in Cana must have been powerful inducement to resist such temptation and wait upon the Father's will. Section 2, Choosing the Six. The 2 weeks missionary tour was a success. The six apostles were beginning to understand the value in personal ministry inasmuch as religion is wholly a matter of personal experience. Andrew assumed charge of their debriefing as the six, one by one, presented their nominees for the new apostles. The new apostles were as follows: Matthew, selected by Andrew; Thomas, selected by Philip; the Alpheus twins, James and Judas, selected by James and John Zebedee, respectively. Simon Zelotes was selected by Peter, and Judas Iscariot was selected by Nathanael. We will delve more into the temperament, character, and life circumstances of each of the apostles in the next paper in this arc. Section 3, The Call of Matthew and Simon. Jesus and the six called upon Matthew at his workplace, and with Jesus' familiar two-word invitation, "Follow me," Matthew went to his house with Jesus and the six. Anticipating this call, Matthew had arranged for a banquet with Jesus as the guest of honor. Simon Zelotes was likewise invited to the banquet. Going to Simon's place of work, Jesus greeted him as he did the others with the invitation, "Follow me." Matthew's family, having long been engaged in tax collection, had many friends attending the banquet who would have been denominated publicans and sinners by the Pharisees. The banquet was characterized by good cheer and lightheartedness, which aroused the critical reaction of Pharisees in attendance, whereupon Jesus reminded them that those who are whole do not need a physician, but rather those who are sick. He has come not to call the righteous, but sinners. The people went to their homes, speaking about one thing, the goodness and friendliness of Jesus. And here ends the summary.
Another excellent summary, Kermit. I really like what you did there. That was a perfect little recap, perfecting recap that you did for us. And you can't say perfect. Does anybody have any follow-up questions or comments?
Perhaps it was a wholly adequate recap. But don't spell holy, H-O-L-Y. Okay, we don't want to turn it into a sacred object. But
or H-O-L-E-Y.
A summary.
Yes, but thank you so much, Kermit, as always. You always did a splendid job of picking your way through both the normal ebb and flow of paragraph to paragraph that we go through, and then our great excursions into long discussions. So thank you.
Does anybody else have any comments on last week's broadcast or any loose ends that we might want to show up before we have quite a bit of reading tonight? So
were you were going to say something there, Justin? Did I hear you making a comment or?
Well, I did have one thing that I thought about this week. I went into Perfecting Horizons Institute, which I highly recommend for anyone to utilize as a resource to try to get a better grasp on this concept of righteousness that we've been touching upon on the show so frequently. And I don't know the exact title of the paper. It was something along the lines of the divine law. And one of the things that struck me is in the past I've often thought of righteousness primarily in connection to taking the light and cultivating that upper domain of spiritualized mind and striking step with the cosmos in that unique sort of dynamic fluid circuit through that ministry of the Holy Spirit. And so I primarily thought of that word in that context. But as I was reading that paper that you wrote, Chris, you pointed out that there is an existential aspect with the word love, truth, beauty, and goodness. And then there's those four other components of representative government, national life, family life, and the preeminence of the individual. And you correlated them with representative government connecting to science and national life connecting to politics, family life connecting to society, and the preeminence of the individual connecting to that word religion. And the thing that I liked the most about that paper was your description of how the planetary prince is starting off the process of sort of initiating this concept of family life and national life, and how the material son and daughter, as the scientific age begins, are beginning on a normal world this process of representative government and initiating that process. And one of the things that made me really think about is trying to think about that word righteousness, conformity in the, with the cosmos, not so much in my inner life only in the context of my desire to strike step with the individuality of the whole and reflectively engage those cosmic intuitions with personality over control, but rather it made me try to think about the literalness of civilization and that law side of righteousness in connection with politics and with society and with representative government and things that are appropriate at this particular moment in the evolutionary process, trying to reflect on what it means as a citizen to engage those issues in a way that is in conformity with the evolutionary process. So I just wanted to highly recommend to anyone to check out that paper.
It's entitled Divine Ideals, The Ways of Righteous Living.
Yes. Yep. That's it.
And I wanted to make a little comment too. So you bringing that up is appropriate. I mean, but before I do, one of the things that you were bringing up there that you were pointing out, you're feeling a little bit subsequently confused about, is that taking delight in cultivating, which I've talked about for years and years on end, highlighting paper 16, section 6, but to reflect on what it is that you're trying to supply favorable conditions to be grown. I mean, we always talk about man cannot cause growth, he can supply favorable conditions, and this very basic fact of reflective thinking as being a favorable condition and such. I mean, that whole bit of growth. I mean, okay, and so you're growing. In what sense are you growing? Your toenails, your fingernails, right? I mean, what are we talking about here? It's your righteousness. It's your conformity with the cosmos that is the stuff that is being grown. Or as Kermit brought up in the review, be you perfect. Okay, you, in what sense? Perfectly groomed? Like I was just joking there? No. See, it's what quality, what fundamental quality of you, of your you-ness, are we talking about being grown, of perfecting? That quality is righteousness. It's conformity with the cosmos. You're taking delight in cultivating, seeing to it that that will grow. Well, once you sort of parse it all out like that, okay, well, before something can grow, it has to exist. Right? See, all we're really doing, in bringing up this issue of righteousness more directly, you know, is just, you know, reminding you that what you want to grow is, you know, not your, you know, natural temperament or, you know, some sort of self-delusional starting point like this that you, you know, you're ever more falling in love with, and you want the universe to honor that and grow it. You know, it's your conformity to the cosmos. That's sort of the quality of your potentially eternal you-ness. I mean, that is the real you. You know, the measure of that quality of your mind or self.
And you know what stood out to me, Chris?
Go ahead.
What stood out to me is that section you referenced on Adam and Eve, how they didn't even begin to initiate the process of representative government due to the state that the planet happened to be in. It wouldn't have been appropriate. And so the thought that crossed my mind that was so interesting is that the uniqueness of the evolutionary stream on any given world is going to determine the appropriate way in which the individual part or citizen will engage each of those four primary concepts at a certain period of time. Representative government's not appropriate, and that would not be in conformity with the cosmos. So the timing of that reflective thinking using wisdom, insight, and foresight to approach those concepts based upon where the current status of development happens to be in that particular civilization at that particular moment in time, that determines the level of conformity with the cosmos.
Right. I mean, it's you're never asked to meet a challenge of conformity with the cosmos until you have the mind capable of it. So with each dispensation, when everyone is sort of reminded, if you will, like we've talked about, that, you know, you have new dispensations of beings on the world. From him to whom much is given, right, much will be expected.
Yeah.
You know, so when you're given more, you have a higher challenge to meet him. And, you know, one of the points I was making there is because of the rebellion to default, this all got short-circuited. But if you're going to take on the challenge of the fifth ethical revelation, you know, they've now restored that lost knowledge about those divine ideals. You have it right now before your eyes that's expected of you. Okay? To rise to the challenge that the God of love has put before you. He loves you infinitely. And because of that, you respond by meeting his expectations. Right? You believe his promises, and you're going to do everything within you to follow his instructions. You know, the instructions that, when all is said and done, are, you know, a how to get to me recipe.
And the synthesis that you did with correlating something like science with representative government, those different groups of four, it really makes it less abstract. It makes it approachable where God's instructions can be something. Take, for instance, the family life. That's something that can be thought of at any stage of development as being a primary focus point as an individual in trying to nurture that as you're moving through the process of civilization. So those instructions become much more clear and much less abstract when you're given that knowledge that we lost.
Yeah, and just another point you're making, I mean, even though, see, when you start talking about things like national life, representative government, you know, your thoughts tend to go outward, you know, and you're thinking about ideas, you know, that apply to issues in the outer life. But so those are divine ideals, not ideas. you know, the challenge is to recognize that, you know, before there are any specific ideas within the concept frame of representative government, that there's an inner life divine ideal, right, that you are consecrating yourself to. I don't, you know, when they give us these specifics that, you know, that go, you know, away from the religion end of the spectrum, right, through society, through politics, all the way to science, don't follow that spectrum unconsciously and turn yourself inside out.
Sure, sure.
Right? The divine ideal of representative government is just as purely in the inner life as the preeminence of the individual. And if it doesn't feel that way initially in your reflection, that's the challenge, to take those all the way up and in and recognize the true ideals that an individual citizen must embody in order for the pursuit of of ideas in the outer life based on these ideals to remain true, for that pursuit to remain true. If you turn it inside out, that's when it can't be true anymore.
And that's
it's
where
going
the objective,
it's some sort of humanistic notion is going to sneak in, and corrupt it. And the point I wanted to bring up, before anyone, we touched on it briefly as I was talking to Kermit, in the show last week, before anyone attempts to try to sort out all this exciting parallel with, this fourfold spectrum and all this sort of stuff, before you get all lost in all those details, you must immutably have the existential divine ideal, right, in place. Certainly before I start to get into the science of government, right, with representative government. But even with the preeminence of the individual, it must, any consecration to those, an attempted consecration to those experiential divine ideals must be predicated right, on the existential divine ideal, right,
love,
of real love. Okay? As I pointed out, you can, when you think about the personal realization of divine fellowship, that helps to challenge some sort of very outer life debased, notion attached to the word symbol love, some intense feeling or whatever. But the Revelators give you a simple little sentence, right, that makes it less abstract than the personal realization of divine fellowship. But if you reflect upon the sentence, just as effective in getting you to something that has only to do with the inner life. That
desire.
Love is the desire to do good to others. Okay? Just think about your inner life as a blank slate. And then you're going to set up an existential founding in that inner life, a desire to do good to others. Right? And that's going to be the predicate, that's going to be the context for everything else. Right? You start with, with purely that, the desire to do good to others, as an inner life inclination, as an inner life motive, to be precise. Right? And then you're going to put everything in that context as a qualifying consideration. I mean, The Universal Father has this absolute infinite desire to do good to others. You go, well, why isn't there just nothing but absolute infinite do-gooding all around me then? Right? Because there are qualifying things that are in it. But that's the initial predicate. That's what you start with, right? In the absence of any qualifying considerations, you're gonna actually do good to others. You know, not just have that inner life desire, but that desire is going to manifest down and out, you know, as actual service. Right? The love will get transformed into loving, you know, love-based service in the outer life.
Yeah.
Right? But
so it's the directionizing.
You've got to keep in mind all those other things, the preeminence of the individual, right? Family life, national life, you know, even representative government, you know, puts a qualifying or a moderating, you know, or even a limiting influence into play so that it isn't just unmitigated father love, like we've talked about. Remember, we talked about this, in general terms, to translate father love into mother love.
Yeah, cosmic totality attitude. Right. Yeah,
right. It's that cosmic totality attitude of mother love is where these four experiential divine ideals.
And would it be appropriate when you emphasize that predicate, that desire to do good to others? When Jesus taught, seek first the kingdom of heaven, the thing that you're going to find in seeking out that inner life is that desire that you're touching upon, correct?
Right. I mean, to recognize that the initial thing you seek is that father-founding existential connection.
Yeah.
You're going to have, like I said, an immutable motivation, drive, inclination in your inner life to do good to others, and then you're going to go, you're going to go out in the world, and someone's going to say to you, it's like, well, Justin, I see you didn't actually quote unquote do good to others there. What's wrong with you? Why have you forsaken the Father? And you said, no, I have two parents, right? And as I translated, right, father love, through mother love into the external world, I recognized that it wouldn't be wise at this time or at this place. Right?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's so
there's
interesting.
There's a wisdom to applying the Father's love.
Yeah.
Right? That's why we aren't just, immersed in a bath, of absolute, infinite do-gooding. Right? Why do bad things happen to good people? We, have long pondered. Right? Because it wouldn't be wise.
It's
yeah,
we've been
totally
touching intentions that... Yeah, those sticky intentions that pave well-known pathways that we hear
mm-hmm.
about that get in the way.
Right.
Initiating directionization of the Father's love can go in many directions.
Yeah, I mean, we've already looked at it. It's very easy to see. You know that there's an immutable desire to do good to others in the inner life of Jesus of Nazareth.
Yep.
And yet, you from the in the outer life, what you can observe of him, you're going, well, I don't know. I'm measuring what's going on here, and I think he's falling way short in handling his family. So that leads me to conclude that he doesn't really have a desire to do good to others, or he would have done good.
We're talking about being nice to others. There's a difference between being nice and being good.
Yeah, I haven't even touched on that. I mean, you've got that issue too. Love is the desire to do good to others. Well, what's your standard of good? I mean, that obviously comes into play. But, let's just assume that we have valid goodness, in mind here. But nonetheless, that if you don't bring in, you know, if you don't bring the father love through wisdom out into the world, then you won't be the benign virus. You'll be the malignant virus of false love.
And would that trip with wisdom, insight,
you have
and
to
foresight?
Have both parents in play. You can't just do it with one parent.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, and just to appreciate that, you know, that there's, as you pointed out, Justin, when you start thinking about, like, you know, representative government relative to the material sons and daughters coming as Adam and Eve and this sort of stuff, you know, there's all of this, specificity of time and place, right, that comes into play, right? There's all of this consideration of the facts of time. But false love thinks that somehow you don't have to consider the facts of time. You're just going to snowplow it all with the Father's love.
Well, all you need is love.
Yeah. You will be the malignant virus.
Self-righteousness.
You will be
yeah.
the reason the book is here, the revelation is here. This false, unwise application of love.
So many things cannot be understood without bringing in the concept of God the Mother, without the concept of having two parents, and we certainly haven't had that ever.
See, and right. And see, the thing that we don't appreciate, if we don't consciously bring in a genuine understanding of God the Mother and all that entails, all the complexity of the cosmos that entails, it doesn't mean that somehow you make magic real and you magically go from the Father's love to an application in the external world. What takes the place of the cosmic totality attitude of the mother if you don't consciously put it into play? You.
Self-righteousness, yeah. Yep.
You are what, you know, you take it down through.
Now,
you are the context.
Yeah.
Right, it's self-righteousness. Right, because, you know, you literally, the physics of it, there has to be some sort of effective, you know, wholeness quality, you know, that you within you that things get reciprocated through from the existential to the experiential. And if it's not the righteousness of the cosmos, then it's you.
Well, without, maybe we don't want to go too far afield, but do you have any practical lessons for avoiding that?
Well, I mean, a lot of it, see, just comes in that very important favorable condition, right, of
humility. Yeah, sure.
Right? I mean, just the innate humility in the sentence, love is the desire. That's not enough for me. Right? I want to go for it. Okay, you aren't humble, are you? Right? If literal father likeness is not enough for you, see, that's all the father has. He has no outer life. Okay? All he has is the desire to do good to others, which he can't translate down and out into actually doing good. The
right.
father can't put himself right. into service. He has no
put
outer life.
Into what?
Into service.
Service. Yeah.
Into service. Okay.
See, he has
sure.
no outer life. Okay?
Yeah.
So, see, but we, well, that's not enough for me. I can't just have, you know, this immutable divine inclination within my inner life. I need to check some boxes of, you know, things I've done out there.
Mm-hmm.
Works right.
Labeled soup,
yeah.
check, you know. Help old lady across the street, check. Right.
Well, it's easy to get confused, for sure.
See, that's you right now. You know, you're telling yourself you're serving God. It's like, no, you're not. You're serving yourself. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Right. Working through a checklist, like you said. Yep.
If the Father's nature is inadequate to you, you have a humility problem. Now, let's see if you can just establish immutably within yourself, you know, with absolute universality, the desire to do good to others. No respecter of persons. Let me see you accomplish that. Once you have that perfect, then we'll talk about service. But if you're still going, well, I don't have a desire to do good to those people or that person.
Yeah,
well, then,
right.
Then you literally can't do good, period. That just told me that your standard of good is faulty. And you will never do good with that predicate. You know,
along
see,
those
with
lines
your,
in terms of...
With your self-righteousness is the starting point rather than God.
Yeah.
Last thing I'll say is that the concept of this desire, this predicate, what you brought up recently, Chris, with unquestioning loyalty and wholehearted devotion to supreme values, those two concepts connected to that predicate, to that desire, seem very significant when I kind of reflect on this idea in the inner life.
I mean, we could kind of just play this out now, but, you know, everyone, you know, try to, you know, work through this, you know, ask questions of your understanding, challenge your understanding, you know, refute your understanding and start all over again, you know, aggressively challenge your concept frame so that you can be revealed to by the fifth epical revelation.
Sure.
Right? That sentence at the end, you know, of that paper, and you know, ending part one there, at the end of paper 56, right, that's not a platitude. Right? Like I said, I challenge everyone listening, right? See if you can completely and perfectly embody that one sentence. And then we'll get into the complex details of the physics of deity or the cosmos or something.
What's the sentence you're referring to, Chris?
Love is the desire to do good to others.
Okay,
right? A very oft-repeated sentence by readership for decades.
Mm-hmm.
I have to confess, in initially reading the high-minded and intricate and well-developed concepts of the revelation, when I ran into that sentence, it felt just like that, Chris. It felt like a platitude. It felt like weak tea. And it just requires more reflection and deeper consideration as you're leading us through now.
I remember very well the first time I read it. It struck me the sentence like, seriously, that's all you got?
couldn't have come up with
a really, you know, poetic zinger there at the end of part one. That's it.
I took a more lazy man's approach.
I was immature.
When I read it the first time, I thought, oh, that's great. That really gets me off the hook for having to work so hard.
Yeah, well, you were parsing it a little bit more than I was. I don't, you know, I won't speak for Kermit, but
oh my God, good. I just need a desire. I like that. All right.
Oh, I got that desire thing down pat. Yeah, but like I'm trying to stress, it's like, do you really? I mean, as soon as that sunk in, just how profound a statement that was. A bunch of things became very clear to me. It's like, So I see some people giving lip service to that sentence, but where are the fruits of this spiritual realization of that sentence in their inner life? I'm not seeing the fruits.
Yeah.
I'm seeing people talking about how they don't have any godlike desire to do good to certain people.
for sure.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge of bringing in God the Mother and wisdom and all that, that is just a gigantic challenge. That's why Jesus didn't even remotely kind of put that forward, right, 2,000 years ago, right, in the fourth epical revelation. Like, no, we're not even going to go there. That's just like, I'm going to be lucky to even get you initiated existentially here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the enormity of just that initial existential challenge. Can you immutably embody the divine ideal of the desire to do good to others? Absolutely no respecter of persons. Right?
Yeah.
Do you constantly monitor it and notice, whoops, I just put in a couple of asterisks on that, except for them and those people and that person over there and my neighbor
Right.
You know,
there are exclusions.
My ex and, et cetera.
Right.
Okay.
Right? I mean, the animal in us wants, remember one of the ancient things is trying to expand the golden rule outward, under an expanding concept of who's your neighbor.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, really, my only neighbors, and that's barely there, is my biologic family. And then you manage to get to your clan, and then you manage to get to your tribe, and et cetera. But that, it's not natural, right, to have a desire to do good to others, and it's even less natural to take that beyond, the end of your biologic nose.
Mm-hmm.
There's those other people.
Right.
That's our natural tendency, is to be very suspicious of others. Right. These things that go back to dawn mammal stuff, right, that are in us. To challenge yourself, right, to just take that one simple thing. Do I immutably embody that? If I don't start bringing in some complicated experiential stuff yet. Right? Jesus said, seek first the kingdom of heaven. Right? Before you try to do anything in your outer life that you're going to call do-gooding.
Mm-hmm.
Even Christianity.
Get your house in order first. Put your right mask on in the airplane before the person next to you.
Even Christianity tentatively approaches this command or this definition with the command to love your enemies. So can we get to the place where we look on others and don't see enemy?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you may have to actually, deal with them as an enemy. It's like, maybe you're a soldier and you've got, your job is to go out and, and shoot bullets at them. Okay, but, you don't shoot those bullets at them with an inner life that is predicated on a hatred to them. You have a desire to do good to others, And then the full qualifying reflection on this, well, what's best for the most people here is that these people need to die.
Oh, that gets
the most
tricky.
High observer has a desire to do good to others. And that's why he wanted Abraham to kill all those people.
Yeah. Right.
See, I said, we can quickly get into some very complicated things when we start thinking about how this is qualified. But, when you actually have to, like when Jesus is talking to the condemned criminal, right? If a society decides they need to execute this person, right? What God is thinking about is not whether or not, a person is going to be executed. It's about whether or not the executioners still maintain a desire to do good to others in their inner life. And then in the complicated outworkings, right, what's best for the greatest number of people for the greatest length of time is that this person, you know, needs to be executed.
Yeah, right.
Strengthening
right.
That gets into the complexities of defining good, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. When I think of moving up,
you don't want to even begin to try to approach these complicated outer life questions about whether or not this person should be executed or not or something like that, you know, until you have it firmly established that absolutely independent of any individuality, any circumstance, anything, you have a desire to do good to others. It's an existential divine ideal. Nothing qualifies that, right, in time and space.
The triplet that comes to mind in Chris in strengthening that eternal inner life desire is that triplet of faith, trust, and assurance, especially that word assurance. It helps me give some sort of direction to the process of cultivating that inner life, moving from faith to trust to that ultimate level of assurance. And that's what you seem to be touching upon, an inner life that's predicated upon this absolute assurance in the inner life.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, if you start with that, you know, that existential divine ideal just, you know, immutably consecrated in the nucleus of your inner life, you know, and then copied by your adjuster into the nucleus of your soul, okay, then you've got something real to build upon, right? And when you begin to play out with the divine ideals that have ever more consequential expressions in the outer life, you will produce those fruits, those expressions, in true form rather than false form.
Yeah, makes sense.
And I can't
form a
true sphere around, an absent nucleus. I need that nucleus, right? That's not me. Right? If the nucleus is me, then it's a false sphere that I form around it. But if it's the fact of God, and God is love, then it will be a true sphere.
That makes sense. All right. Well, should we get on with the reading here?
This sort of discussion would not be something we would have with our next two apostles. that would have been playing over their head.
That's right. Yeah, tonight we're going to be introducing the remaining four apostles that were chosen by the first six. And then we'll get down to a week of intensive training that they do. And then, of course, there's got to be another disappointment. So tonight we begin our reading in paper 138, section 4, and that's on page 1541 in the single column edition of the Urantia book. Okay. And I'll start the reading here for us. The Call of the Twins. On the morrow, all nine of them went by boat over to Carissa to execute the formal calling of the next two apostles, James and Judas, the twin sons of Alphaeus, the nominees of James and John Zebedee. The fisherman twins were expecting Jesus and his apostles and were therefore awaiting them on the shore. James Zebedee presented the master to the Carissa fishermen, and Jesus, gazing on them, nodded and said, "Follow me."
Just like Kermit mentioned in the review, there it is, just the two words, "Follow me."
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see this again when we get to the final two apostles. Notice the described by the midwares coordination of things that's going on here. They're waiting for them, right?
Yeah.
And, this is not like, a 5-minute trip in the boat. I mean, they're going, you know, all the way across the Sea of Galilee. You know, and
all nine of them.
So how much this was kind of prearranged, you know, when they were going to be there and this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
They mentioned that with Matthew too. He was expecting them, so there was a lot of foreplay, so to speak, in this calling.
Yeah, but you know, what that see in between the lines that speaks to, you know, you got these people that Jesus is having a hard time keeping them from not flying off on zealous, you know, patriotic tangents and stuff like this. Okay, but even before he kind of really commissions them to get things really organized, there's some organization that they just do naturally. Of course, like say if you're a fisherman, if you live a haphazard life, you won't live long. You'll die out there in the middle of the lake in a storm or something. You know, or you know, you'll just starve to death or whatever. Right? There has to be, notice that he's picked people to be his apostles that naturally have some eye to material pragmatism. You know, and he's going to try to work on getting them to have a genuine eye of spiritual idealism rather than just, you know, some sort of falsely exalted material woo-woo, you know, that they call idealism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if they didn't have some material pragmatism, you know, he would end up with fanatics. You know, there wouldn't be any natural tempering. We talk about that all the time. Someone reading the fifth epical revelation that's very cosmic in perspective, not just merely spiritual, you know, how much you need both eyes. Well, then there's just the issue of if you don't have both eyes, you know, you'll probably just be some crazy fanatic because of the book.
Yeah.
Right.
And Jesus is constantly tempering them to keep their feet on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in a sense, see, they have so much relationship to the material that, you know, they have delusions that part of that material stuff is spiritual.
Right.
But, you know, he can work on, you know, on that. But, you know, if you're in front of Jesus and you don't have any material consciousness, you know, we'll watch you float off into the stratosphere because you won't stay grounded.
That's funny. Okay, that afternoon, which they spent together, Jesus fully instructed them concerning attendance upon festive gatherings, concluding his remarks by saying, "All men are my brothers. My Father in heaven does not despise any creature of our making. The kingdom of heaven is open to all men and women. No man may close the door of mercy in the face of any hungry soul who may seek to gain entrance thereto. We will sit at meat with all who desire to hear of the kingdom. As our Father in heaven looks down upon men, they are all alike. Refuse not, therefore, to break bread with Pharisee or sinner, Sadducee or publican, Roman or Jew, rich or poor, free or bond. The door of the kingdom is wide open for all who desire to know the truth and to find God."
Okay, so right there you can see the Father has the desire to do good to all others. This is what we were just talking about.
Right. Yep.
Desire to do good to others combined with no respecter of persons. Okay. But notice the qualifier repeated even in there to make sure it's not lost. Okay, so, you know, you could easily miss that, you know, if you don't have an eye of material pragmatism and you just go off indiscriminately trying to pour out the Father's love everywhere. You know, Jesus said, you know, you know, we should break bread with Pharisee or sinner, et cetera. Okay, but he also said the only people we're talking about here is those who may seek to gain an entrance thereto. Those who
right.
desire
hungry
to know the
desires.
Truth and find God.
To hear of the kingdom.
Right.
Your
yeah.
discriminators have to be on.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there is no such thing as proper random acts of kindness.
Hmm.
Right? We're seeing it here, right? It's going to be wide open, but the period isn't right there. Right? It isn't. Yeah, the door of the kingdom is wide open. Period. No, that's not where the period is in the sentence.
Yeah.
It's wide open for all who desire to know the truth and to find God. See, that's where I come in. I have to do my part. I have to have that desire to found my inner life on the fact of God, on the divine law. And I have to have a desire for righteousness. Then the door is wide open for me. Otherwise, you know, don't think of the door as being closed. There is no door. See, it's not like the old dual spiritism thing where, you're not, seeking righteousness, so I'm going to close the door in your face. It's like, no, there is no door at all for someone like that. Right? That whole bit of Jesus said, I never knew you. And he didn't say, yeah, I heard you on the other side of the door, but I kept it closed. That isn't what he said. He said, I never knew you. There was no door.
Yeah, you didn't even make an attempt.
The door is in my domain of sovereignty. I'm the only one that can see to the existence of the door.
Right.
Yeah.
That word seek to gain an entrance thereto, it really helps to emphasize Jesus' phrase, seek the kingdom of heaven as well.
Yeah.
And see, just seek to gain an entrance, of course. Right? Again, saying it that way so you don't think that you're gaining the ending. It's like, no, step one is to see if you can get across the threshold. Then we'll, let's get you born again, and then we'll talk about the long, complex, cosmic journey to being born again.
Yeah.
Let's start with the spiritual born again.
Yep.
All of these qualifications, they're very important to notice. Right? Otherwise, it just sends you off on this false love, quest or whatever, missionary journey. So, that discriminating is important. Yeah, and just notice it's in the context of seeming to not be a discriminator, Roman or Jew, rich or poor. But then don't be an irrelevant discriminator, but there's a real discrimination, right?
Yeah.
God doesn't know the difference between someone, who is founding their inner life on him or not, but he doesn't know any other distinction. He doesn't know if you're male or female or Roman or Jew or whatever. But if he knows whether or not you've started with him or not.
He knows that desire, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That night at a simple supper at the Alpheus home, the twin brothers were received into the apostolic family. Later in the evening, Jesus gave his apostles their first lesson dealing with the origin, nature, and destiny of unclean spirits, but they could not comprehend the import of what he told them. They found it very easy to love and admire Jesus, but very difficult to understand many of his teachings.
And so remember back then, amongst those people, it was very common to call, what others have called evil spirits, call them unclean spirits, right? That whole focus on cleanliness, as it were.
Right.
What are we talking about? We're talking about midwares, right? You know, as the revelators point out in paper 77, when you're seeing, you know, unclean spirits or evil spirits, so he's trying to give them a lesson about the origin, nature, and destiny of midway creatures. You know, maybe just limiting it to secondary midway creatures, you might speculate. And they're just, what on earth is he talking about? their eyes are just
glazed pretty
over.
Interesting. It's a pretty interesting tale in our time as well.
Yes. But just to make sure everyone's clear on what we're talking about, you know, he's not giving him a lecture on the woo-woo of the ghost cult. He's talking about the truth, if you will, of that notion of unclean spirits.
Yeah, and to be going over the origin, nature, and destiny, no wonder their eyes glazed over.
Yeah. Well, that word destiny is significant.
A fifth epical revelers go, even in a little issue like that, right, he gave it that full threefold.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Origin, history, destiny, right? So just little lessons like that, you know, to always, if you're going to try to, you know, approach someone with, you know, make sure you do it in that full context. Don't do it in part-wise fashion. They may glaze over, right? But, you know, it's better to have your effort at conveying truth to fail than to have your effort to proselytize falsehood succeed.
Precisely.
After a night of rest, the entire party, now numbering 11, went by boat over to Terrakia.
Right, so now they're going all the way down to the south end of the lake, right? So they're making these long journeys across the lake, and I bet you when they get there, someone will be waiting for him. Let's see.
Section 5, The Call of Thomas and Judas. Thomas the fisherman and Judas the wanderer met Jesus and the apostles at the fisher boat landing at Terrakia, and Thomas led the party to his nearby home. Philip now presented Thomas as his nominee for apostleship, and Nathanael presented Judas Iscariot, the Judean, for similar honors. Jesus looked upon Thomas and said, Thomas, you lack faith. Nevertheless, I receive you. Follow me. To Judas Iscariot, the master said, Judas, we are all of one flesh, and as I receive you into our midst, I pray that you will always be loyal to your Galilean brethren. Follow me. Oh, boy, there's some foreboding.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell Kermit was noticing, wait a minute, this doesn't just say follow me. So we have all of these very simple, I mean, even with Simon, right? Simon Zelotes, he just said follow me, right? But if you recall, right, the other one that he's, you know, given some little predicate before he said follow me, like these two, was Nathanael. Right? He said, behold, a genuine Israelite in whom there is no deceit, follow me.
Right.
And interesting, after a little comment from, you know, Nathanael there, if you go back and look at, you know, Jesus repeated it. You know, he gave Nathanael two follow me's. So Nathanael's the only one that got two follow me's. But he gave a little commentary for Nathanael, and boy, the commentary he gives here, like, I mean, wow, Thomas, it's like, you know, he walks up to him, sticks a knife in him, and says, follow me.
maybe it's just what Thomas needed.
It's like, wow, okay, that's quite the, you know, the first words the master speaks to you is, you lack faith.
You lack faith, yeah.
Nevertheless.
And it makes you wonder if he's referencing, in general, a faith graph that's lacking, or specifically faith in the master himself, and it might be a little of both.
Well, you know, and again, it's, you know, it gets into this issue that we've been talking about, you know, in kind of more complex detail. But let's remember to boil it down when we talk about, just beginning to wrap your mind around the notion of righteousness. How to understand, what is embodied in that seemingly straightforward word faith.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You know, and that you've got those two elements, right? That, it's not just believing God's promises. You know, merely believing God's promises is not, quote-unquote, faith in God. It's believing his promise, believing God's promises, and following his instructions. And that faith has that, in many ways, kind of unspoken, foundation to it, of some concept that there's his instructions, right? That there's the divine law. And that you must, such and so. Right.
Yeah.
So when Jesus says, you lack faith, you're going, well, is it? You think about it, is it belief that he lacks? He probably has belief. You see, Jesus is pointing out you haven't quite put the basic little simple thing together. You have this tendency to kind of be a little bit too advanced for your time.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this is Thomas we're talking about,
yeah.
And he's going to have some inclination to think, I don't know, that his instructions, that sounds like some primitive superstitious notion. I don't think that's his instructions.
He's got a little bit of that
scientific mind.
He was born to refute.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, so right off the bat, he has a tricky thing of, having genuine faith, that you've got to follow his instructions. How can you achieve that unquestioning loyalty if you're already doubting, Thomas?
Doubting Thomas.
Yeah.
See, that's what Jesus is getting at.
Okay.
Yeah, and then, of course,
the
foreshadowing
looks,
of Judas. Go ahead, Kermit.
Just one other, this is sort of tangential, but just looking at where these guys went when Jesus sent them out on their little two-week missionary trip, two by two, Philip and Nathaniel went to Tarichia, and you suspect that there may have been some interaction during that time, because Chareza was also visited by the guys who called the Alpheus twins, and you wonder if there wasn't some pre-conversation like we were talking about, the pre-organization in
planning of it.
So I just wondered. I don't know, but because he didn't tell them to choose apostles at that point, did he? They didn't go out on that missionary trip knowing they were going to choose another one. Oh, they did. Maybe
they
discussed it.
Yeah.
Okay, then they probably
that
talked it over with their candidates. They talked it over with their candidates then. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, there's just that little commission that Jesus gave them to go out and find another. Each of you find one more.
Okay. So they were looking.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they were looking, and they made contact when they were out there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I was saying before, obviously, you know, they had a sense of the timing of, you know, going back to Jesus, you know, and then them going out to pick him up and everything. You know, it's not like, yeah, and Thomas and Judas had been standing at the shore, you know, for 3 days, and finally they, you know, I mean, obviously, they knew when and where, you know, to be waiting. So
that
kind of neat little planning, see, that's underlying these statements.
When they had refreshed themselves, Jesus took the 12 apart for a season to pray with them and to instruct them in the nature and work of the Holy Spirit. But again, did they largely fail to comprehend the meaning of those wonderful truths which he endeavored to teach them? One would grasp one point and one would comprehend another, but none of them could encompass the whole of his teaching. Always would they make the mistake of trying to fit Jesus' new gospel into their old forms of religious belief. They could not grasp the idea that Jesus had come to proclaim a new gospel of salvation and to establish a new way of finding God. They did not perceive that he was a new revelation of the Father in heaven.
Okay, so here's some kind of significant statements again. And notice, so sort of when he goes beyond kind of things about unclean spirits, when he starts to get into sort of the basic philosophic framing, that he's trying to give them in order to reveal, a truer recognition of the Father, see, what does he talk about? Now, just like we saw when he started, when he gave that first little sermon on the kingdom, what's the kingdom tied to? Not the spirit of truth, not thought of jesters, and no, the Holy Spirit.
And notice the little pun when they say always would they would encompass the whole of his teaching.
Exactly. Yes, that little twinkle there that and I was just going to make that point. Yeah, exactly, Justin. See, why are they struggling? It's because they have just an almost complete tendency to think part-wise, right? To understand parts starting with parts. It's like, no, you can't truly understand parts unless you start with the whole. Right? And see, he's trying to, give them that basic philosophic framing that, this new wineskin that I'm trying to put you in so that you can understand the kingdom of heaven, you need to start with the whole, which is the nature and work of the Holy Spirit. Think about that line where, and to establish a new way of finding God. What's a very basic expression of that new way that we bring up all the time? He's trying to show them the way of finding God in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. See, before that, they'd been trying to find God part-wise.
Yeah.
Well, he's another part. He's around here somewhere. Let's go searching for him. Oh, there he is in this tabernacle I set up.
Yeah, he's up on that mountain.
Right, or whatever, yeah. Say, no, to find God in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole, that's how you find the real God. Because this distinction is vital. Right? Just like we say all the time. And, so there's that, all that about, starting with wholeness, starting whole-wise instead of part-wise, which is a little bit of philosophy, that he's putting in there. But then, then the more religious side, the new gospel of salvation. And, of course, it's not literally a new gospel of salvation. It's new relative to the old forms of religious belief they have, right? As they say there.
Right.
And what's the deal with that? Right. It's an outer life works righteousness. Right. That's the old form of their religious belief. Right. And he wants to get them back to what Machaventa, the first and second epical revelations before that too. But back to Machaventa, and it's like, no, it's salvation through faith. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So salvation through faith is the quote unquote new old gospel of salvation. Remember the Melchizedek gospel was literally trust in God and salvation through faith.
Yeah.
Trust and faith, yep.
Yep, trust and faith. And if you expand it out, it's trust in God and salvation through faith. That's the Melchizedek gospel.
Huh.
And then we just talked about, what Machaventa was trying to teach them about, what faith meant. To believe God's promises and follow his instructions. But, if you recall in that passage where he's, they're talking about that, the comment is, heretofore it had been believed that salvation could be secured only by works.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what Jesus is, that's the old forms that Jesus is trying to challenge.
We haven't come very far.
Works righteousness.
Yeah.
No, it's still very prominent. Yeah.
Very much, and not just in Christianity either.
No, because it's natural. See, works righteousness is natural, right? I mean, you having the word
for nothing.
Word righteousness in your dictionary is not natural, but you have no idea what it applies to. So you apply it naturally, right, in the outer life.
Yeah, sure.
With some notion that you dream up, right?
It's transactional.
Well, when the outer life is all you have, what else can you see?
Right. I mean, historically, it was always some flavor of sacrifices and offerings, was kind of the key to that whole works righteousness, right? But, even if you go forward in time and it gets fancier and fancier, and it isn't just, I think we need to sacrifice a bull, it's really no different because it's still outer life works righteousness, and it's just nice nihilism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Justin, would you like to take over the reading now? Is this a good time for you? Or?
Sure thing, okay. Yeah. Thanks, Andrea.
Sure.
The next day, Jesus left his 12 apostles quite alone. He wanted them to become acquainted and desired that they be alone to talk over what he had taught them. The master returned for the evening meal, and during the after-supper hours, he talked to them about the ministry of seraphim, and some of the apostles comprehended his teaching. They rested for a night, and the next day departed by boat for Capernaum.
Well, there he goes again. avoiding the whole, seraphim that have gone dark thing. Just trying to approach proper seraphic ministry. Notice the interesting thing there that and some of the apostles comprehended his teaching, they said there. You can think about the obvious reason why this would be different than when he was trying to talk about the midwares, the rebel midwares. He isn't so challenged by all of the baggage they have in the ghost cult framework about unclean spirits. Remember how much they tied that to, people being sick and whatnot, and you've got a hangnail. Oh, you're possessed by an unclean spirit. But with seraphim, the ideas that were still percolating around from things that former revelators had said, he could play off of that more effectively, and they weren't so confused. The simple lesson there is, as you're going through all the stuff in the fifth epoch of Revelation, think about how your natural tendency is going to be to interpret it very improperly when you're dealing with stuff that you think you know a lot about.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have all kinds of preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices that are going to be in play.
Yeah.
Sort of the closer it hits the home, the more likely you are to start off on the wrong foot with it.
And you might have already crystallized those in the upper domain, too.
Oh, yeah. By the way, speaking of wrong foot, we didn't even mention that. Right, in the preceding paragraph, always would they make the mistake of trying to fit Jesus' new gospel into their old form of religious belief. We've talked about that before. How is it this is literally evil we're talking about?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's self-disrupting. See, when they don't start with the whole, when they don't approach it whole-wise, then they can't start with the essence of that wholeness, unity. They're going to start with individuality, which is disrupting of the unity foundation. Right? That's evil. And so that basic physics again is in play. Of because you can't ever literally turn yourself inside out. You still have an inner life. It's just that you're going to conceive of it in the outer life and then drag that into your inner life as a self-disrupting evil, that individuality-based starting point. So, notice that they always, are trying to remind us of that, that it, it starts out very innocently. Evil is, inescapable because it's just, in our immature innocence, it's unavoidable. We're just naturally going to start with an outer life material individuality, and then falsely spiritualize it.
Right.
Zebedee and Salome had gone to live with their son David so that their large home could be turned over to Jesus and his 12 apostles. Here Jesus spent a quiet Sabbath with his chosen messengers. He carefully outlined the plans for proclaiming the kingdom and fully explained the importance of avoiding any clash with the civil authorities, saying, "If the civil rulers are to be rebuked, leave that task to me. See that you make no denunciations of Caesar or his servants." It was this same evening that Judas Iscariot took Jesus aside to inquire why nothing was done to get John out of prison. And Judas was not wholly satisfied with Jesus' attitude.
Beginning of discontent.
Yeah, right. You mean you've got the thing with Judas, obviously, that's there. Yes, he's already has a little thread of discontent there. But the common theme besides Judas's issues is he has to work on them not doing things through the lens of wisdom. Right? Don't just take some inner life existential thing and just zealously throw it out there. Right? Well, I'm going to denounce Caesar, right? Or I'm going to bust John out of prison. You could do that, but it wouldn't be wise. Right? And it's not just Judas that's dance to the wisdom of things.
Right.
Section 6.
So again, that basic lesson of, have you taken the Father love and forgotten to put it through, the cosmic totality attitude before you put it out there, right? Or do you just unwisely, project that out into the world as a a dark influence, not a light influence.
Yeah.
Section 6, the week of intensive training.
The next week was devoted to a program of intense training. Each day, the six new apostles were put in the hands of their respective nominators for a thoroughgoing review of all they had learned and experienced in preparation for the work of the kingdom. The older apostles carefully reviewed, for the benefit of the younger six, Jesus' teachings up to that hour. Evenings, they all assembled in Zebedee's garden to receive Jesus' instruction.
In this particular context, Jesus is constantly looking for ways to make his engagement to mankind more evolutional, right?
Yeah.
Downstepping it through the six to the other six, for instance, like we're seeing here, rather than, Adam and Eve mating directly, right, as it were, right? It's only their offspring that mate. That sort of downstepping of, of those who come from above, try to make it as evolutional. You're seeing this is the parallel to that second epical revelation. Downstepping, you're seeing here in Jesus, having a first generation set of apostles and a second generation, just like Adam and Eve had a first generation. And it's that first generation that actually engaged the others then, not them directly.
That's very interesting. I wouldn't have picked up on that.
As well as that, the significance of that principle of teaching to others what you've just learned, too.
Of course, yeah.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. It's just, either way you want to look at it, bottom up or top down, but, how patient Jesus is, how much he knows that he has to hand this into the evolutionary process, and if that's going to happen, he has to start by, unnaturally engaging it as evolutionally as possible. He's not going to be here for, millions of years and engaging it in a literal evolutionary fashion, right? But to try to make it so that it's something that can get caught up in the evolutionary process and go forward.
It was at this time that Jesus established the midweek holiday for rest and recreation, and they pursued this plan of relaxation for one day each week throughout the remainder of his material life. As a general rule, they never prosecuted their regular activities on Wednesday. On this weekly holiday, Jesus would usually take himself away from them, saying, "My children, go for a day of play. Rest yourselves from the arduous labors of the kingdom and enjoy the refreshment that comes from reverting to your former vocations or from discovering new sorts of recreational activity." While Jesus, at this period of his earth life, did not actually require this day of rest, he conformed to this plan because he knew it was best for his human associates. Jesus was the teacher, the master. His associates were his pupils, disciples.
So, Chris, I have a question for you. Would you find it refreshing to go back to your former vocation?
I think I'll go fishing.
Okay. That's what I thought. Me too.
I'll pass, thank you. But I was feeling nostalgic for a culture that, at least was in some parts of the United States not long past, that at least Wednesday evening was devoted to just doing things with your church community, right? And
right.
not your secular community.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
That tradition, carrying all the way to the 20th century from Jesus' time here.
Yeah.
Jesus endeavored to make clear to his apostles the difference between his teachings and his life among them, and the teachings which might subsequently spring up about him. Said Jesus, "My kingdom and the gospel related thereto shall be the burden of your message. Be not sidetracked into preaching about me and about my teachings, proclaim the gospel of the kingdom, and portray my revelation of the Father in heaven, but do not be misled into the bypaths of creating legends and building up a cult having to do with beliefs and teachings about my beliefs and teachings. But again, they did not understand why he thus spoke, and no man dared to ask why he so taught them.
And the Wrench book readers did not understand why he thus spoke.
Yeah, sure glad they got that one straight.
Yes, I mean, how can you avoid see how complicated it is. Once you have the fifth epistle of Revelation, we have a third of the book is the life and teachings of Jesus. Okay, now that's not some sort of defiance of Michael of Nebadon, right? As you know, a superficial reading of this paragraph might lead you to think, like, oh, and it's all about, you know, him and his teachings. Third of the book, okay. But you know, think about what that means. If you have the Urantia book in hand, and you're approaching someone who doesn't have step one in place yet, what Jesus was trying to put in place, right, which is not about Jesus and his teachings, right, it's about the kingdom and the gospel of the kingdom, right, so you know, it just reminds you of how problematic it can be to just throw the Urantia book out there to those who don't have the proper fourth epical predicate. Yeah, not unlike I was just saying about getting to the four experiential divine ideals if you haven't established the existential divine ideal.
Yeah.
Right? You get the exact same thing they tell you here. You get that prefix M-I-S. Wrong.
Yeah.
Do not be misled into the bypass. See, I mean, it actually, you want to go about doing good, but instead you're doing evil. So
in these early,
I just want to, you know, pause on that a moment. I mean, you know, notice how many times they italicize things in this paragraph.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They're just pounding at us. Right? You know, and this is not so that you are somehow, you know, can think about very self-righteously about how confused the apostles were about this. Boy, am I glad I'm not like those apostles back then, really confused by what Jesus said. Right?
Yeah.
The italics is for us, not for us to, you know, look down our noses at the apostles. Can we take that paragraph to heart? And just how complicated that is when you literally have the title of part four is the life and teachings of Jesus.
And don't we all, and I mean, I confess to enjoy sitting around with believers and recounting stories of Jesus and his doings and his teachings. So that's a tough call. I guess
it is.
Doing it with
is
believers is one
thing.
Is there
a natural tendency to sit around and talk about the kingdom of heaven?
Yeah.
No. The tendency to sit around and talk about Jesus and what he was up to.
Right. Yeah.
That's the tricky thing, and to just recognize how natural it is to be misled into the bypass, right? You know, and how problematic this might be for some, you know, beginning individual out there that you're over-teaching.
Yes.
By literally just dumping directly the teachings of Jesus on them. Instead of the gospel of the kingdom. Going out, you know, like I said many times, going out there thinking of yourself as an ambassador of Jesus, ambassador of the fourth epical revelation, and taking the Arantia book with you. It's like, no, you're supposed to take the faith of Jesus out there in your inner life if you're on that mission, not the Arantia book. And this paragraph is telling you directly that you shouldn't be taking a book that's got one-third of it with the teachings of Jesus in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're supposed to have the faith. Right? Those people need the Melchizedek gospel that we just talked about. They need that beginning step. Trust in God and salvation through faith. Right? And help them to know that faith isn't just credulous belief. And that God is not a delusion.
Right.
In these early teachings, Jesus sought to avoid controversies with his apostles as far as possible, accepting those involving wrong concepts in his Father in heaven. In all such matters, he never hesitated to correct erroneous beliefs. There was just one motive in Jesus' post-baptismal life on Urantia, and that was a better and truer revelation of his paradise Father. He was the pioneer of the new and better way to God, the way of faith and love. Ever his exhortation to the apostles was, go seek for the sinners, find the downhearted, and comfort the anxious.
You're an evangelist of the fourth epical revelation. There's just one motive, a better and truer revelation of our Father in heaven, not the life and teachings of Jesus.
Right.
And I understand what I'm saying, how difficult this is, the kind of passion we all feel for this glorious material that we're studying right now on air, part 4.
Exactly.
But understand, you know, that the world is filled with many who still sit in darkness. And they don't, you know, they need the gospel of the fourth epical revelation. Yeah? You know, because, you know, just like Jesus was not, you know, motivated by a better and truer expose of himself. It doesn't say that.
Jesus had a perfect grasp of the situation. He possessed unlimited power, which might have been utilized in the furtherance of his mission, but he was wholly content with means and personalities which most people would have regarded as inadequate and would have looked upon as insignificant. He was engaged in a mission of enormous, dramatic possibilities, but he insisted on going about his Father's business in the most quiet and undramatic manner. He studiously avoided all display of power, and he now planned to work quietly, at least for several months, with his 12 apostles around about the Sea of Galilee.
Yeah, just probably the one, you know, comment I'd make there is, you know, regarded as inadequate. The way my mind has been trained in the secular world that I grew up in, I can't help but have some bias against the intellectually limited. You know, and to think, I mean, seriously, Jesus, you didn't give any predicate. You just looked at the Alpheus twins and said, follow me. Don't you regard them as inadequate? And their potential impact is insignificant? Shouldn't you have taken a better marketing class, Jesus?
He's representing the Father.
See, I mean, the most humble and unlearned can embody the faith of Jesus and go out into the world.
And he's no respecter of persons.
But the Alpheus twins couldn't give a lecture on the life and teachings of Jesus.
Right.
See, again, that, just over and over again, you see it's clear. And what's the name of the final paper?
Yeah.
That's what you take out into the world as an evangel of the fourth epical revelation, a real inner life that has the quality of the faith of Jesus. Nothing else.
Well, Kermit, good sir, this is a long section. I'm going to pass it off to you.
Okay. I'll be...
Yeah, but he's going to finish most of it after he reads the first paragraph.
Another disappointment, number seven. Jesus had planned for a quiet missionary campaign of 5 months personal work. He did not tell the apostles how long this was to last. They worked from week to week. And early on, this first day of the week, just as he was about to announce this to the 12 apostles, Simon Peter, James Zebedee, and Judas Iscariot came to have private converse with him. Taking Jesus aside, Peter made bold to say, "Master, we come at the behest of our associates to inquire whether the time is not now ripe to enter into the kingdom. And will you proclaim the kingdom at Capernaum, or are we to move on to Jerusalem? And when shall we learn, each of us, the positions we are to occupy with you in the establishment of the kingdom?" And Peter would have gone on asking further questions, but Jesus raised an admonitory hand and stopped him. And beckoning the other apostles standing nearby to join them, Jesus said, "My little children, how long shall I bear with you? Have I not made it plain to you that my kingdom is not of this world? I have told you many times that I have not come to sit on David's throne. And now, how is it that you are inquiring which place each of you will occupy in the Father's kingdom? Can you not perceive that I have called you as ambassadors of a spiritual kingdom? Do you not understand that soon, very soon, you are to represent me in the world and in the proclamation of the kingdom, even as I now represent my Father who is in heaven? Can it be that I have chosen you and instructed you as messengers of the kingdom, and yet you do not comprehend the nature and significance of this coming kingdom, of divine preeminence in the hearts of men? My friends, hear me once more. Banish from your minds this idea of my kingdom, that my kingdom is a rule of power or a reign of glory. Indeed, all power in heaven and on earth will presently be given into my hands, but it is not the Father's will that we use this divine endowment to glorify ourselves during this age. In another age, you shall indeed sit with me in power and glory, but it behooves us now to submit to the will of the Father and to go forth in humble obedience to execute his bidding on earth."
And they, all they remembered was, well, he said that he would be back in another age. That probably means just a few months after his ascension, in his second coming. And then...
then we'll get our assignments.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
But, you get to the middle of the paragraph there, and how long shall I bear with you? And you feel like inserting in a little, annotation. And from that point on until his death, he always had a red patch in the middle of his forehead from pounding his head against the wall.
Yes. Oh, dear.
Oh, man.
I wonder if they used the phrase oy vey back then.
Some equivalent for sure.
It's just hilarious. You can tell Peter took a really deep breath, and he was going to roll out 50 sentences without breathing.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the description of the significance of this coming kingdom of divine preeminence in the hearts of men.
Preeminence. Yeah. That's probably just a coincidental use of the same word.
I wonder how many times, when I saw it, I wondered how many times it actually is used in the book.
Remember, that's, you know, just like you had the national life and family life with the first epical revelation, and you were supposed to have representative government with the second. Right? I mean, Jesus gave us the preeminence of the individual. That's one of the key things, you know, that he presented, is that, you know, as a religious uplifter, right, he was presenting that divine ideal about the inner life. You know,
that
there's a
never...
real preeminence of the individual, not a delusional one. There's a real one, because there's a part of you that was created and not born.
Is that why you should never give advice unless it's been asked for, because of the fundamental preeminence of the individual? Is it related?
Yeah, that's related. I mean, when all is said and done, you have that overarching respect by all celestial beings for personality, right? And it's inner life sovereignty, right?
I told
it doesn't matter how much you can't project how that's going to work out well. You need to trust God, like Machiavelli said. Trust in God.
I told my mom on the weekend, I said, never give advice unless it's asked for. And she said, oh, that's a stupid idea.
Why do you think God gave me a mouth?
Exactly.
Except to give advice when it's not asked for.
And children to give it to, yes.
And children to give it to, yes.
Yeah, and when you think about that concept of being created equal, not being born equal, and you think about the encirclement of the Holy Spirit and that moment of the initiation of the upper domain of your mind, having a genuine inner life, it's almost a recognition of deity that you're recognizing in terms of that created equal. You're seeing the mother. You're like, whoa. The created equal thing's not an individuality thing. It's coming from above. That's why it's equal.
Fundamental quality of deity is unity.
Yes.
Once more were his associates shocked, stunned. Jesus sent them away two and two to pray, asking them to return to him at noontime. On this crucial forenoon, they each sought to find God, and each endeavored to cheer and strengthen the other, and they returned to Jesus as he had bidden them.
Just, you know, we need a quasi-forced humility lesson. He sent them off, got them to do a little time out.
But it looks like they took him to heart and were in earnest about following his instructions.
Right, as they're about to explain. I mean, Jesus has some leverage that he can apply, and he does, as they're going to explain in the next paragraph.
Jesus now recounted for them the coming of John, the baptism in the Jordan, the marriage feast at Cana, the recent choosing of the six, and the withdrawal from them of his own brothers in the flesh, and warned them that the enemy of the kingdom would seek also to draw them away. After this short but earnest talk, the apostles all arose under Peter's leadership to declare their undying devotion to their master and to pledge their unswerving loyalty to the kingdom, as Thomas expressed it. To this coming kingdom, no matter what it is, and even if I do not fully understand it, they all truly believed in Jesus, even though they did not fully comprehend his teaching.
So he wants to get them to that goal of believing with him.
Right.
He's going to leverage the initial powerful believing in him. Right?
Right.
And hold them together. And just one little quickie there, because I don't have a lot of time here, but notice that his own brothers in the flesh had withdrawn from them and warned them that the enemy of the kingdom would seek to also draw them away. Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
Yeah,
right.
I mean, you know, obviously he's speaking in terms they can immediately understand, right, if, you know what I'm saying. But, you know, at another point, you know, they speak of enemies of the kingdom.
Yeah.
Right? The ungodly. Right? What's the enemy of the kingdom of righteousness? The ungodly.
Self?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, self is, yeah. I mean, that's the fulcrum, of, you know, that you stumble over. But you know, it's the ungodly, right? And that's why Psalm 1 starts out, blessed is the man that does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly.
Right, because they'll draw him away. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Jesus now asked them how much money they had among them. He also inquired as to what provision had been made for their families. When it developed that they had hardly sufficient funds to maintain themselves for 2 weeks, he said, "It is not the will of my Father that we begin our work in this way. We will remain here by the sea 2 weeks and fish or do whatever our hands find to do. And in the meantime, under the guidance of Andrew, the first chosen apostle, you shall so organize yourselves as to provide for everything needful in your future work, both for the present personal ministry and also when I shall subsequently ordain you to preach the gospel and instruct believers." They were all greatly cheered by these words. This was their first clear-cut and positive intimation that Jesus designed later on to enter upon more aggressive and pretentious public efforts.
And of course, you know, the wisdom of Jesus, you know, because they can't believe with him. Yeah, but I can assign them the task of getting, you know, the material affairs in order, and they jump right to it, and they're greatly cheered.
right.
The
apostles spent the remainder of the day perfecting their organization and completing arrangements for boats and nets for embarking on the morrow's fishing, as they had all decided to devote themselves to fishing. Most of them had been fishermen. Even Jesus was an experienced boatman and fisherman. Many of the boats which they used the next few years had been built by Jesus' own hands, and they were good and trustworthy boats.
Hmm. It's almost like they believed in him.
Of course they were.
They got in his boats and felt secure. They believed in him. The literalness of that. So, you know, so close to that. Just, you know, notice that. That's not a coincidence. You know, that they're juxtaposing those.
Jesus enjoined them to devote themselves to fishing for 2 weeks, adding, "And then will you go forth to become fishers of men?" They fished in three groups, Jesus going out with a different group each night. And they all so much enjoyed Jesus. He was a good fisherman, a cheerful companion, and an inspiring friend. The more they worked with him, the more they loved him. Said Matthew one day, "The more you understand some people, the less you admire them. But of this man, even the less I comprehend him, the more I love him."
It's so precious. Yeah.
It is.
His little children.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fishing
and,
there
and
right
course,
with
there
him.
It is. There's the fishers of men, you know, the classic.
Yep.
The classic expression there.
Right.
I wonder if there'll be followers that will use a fish logo to represent their movement.
Well, everybody needs a logo. Come on.
But yeah, see, all of that starts right here. You know, the Ichthus starts right here.
Right.
You know, so that, you know, it's a precious paragraph. You know, both in that sense and in the very personal you know, testimonial from Matthew there.
And there's the occasional exclamation point in there. Yeah. This plan of fishing 2 weeks and going out to do personal work in behalf of the kingdom for 2 weeks was followed for more than 5 months, even to the end of this year, AD 26, until after the cessation of those special persecutions which had been directed against John's disciples subsequent to his imprisonment.
Ah, so we end with an interesting little footnote of some material pragmatism-based wisdom. You know, Jesus, it all seems like Jesus just wants to really, you know, teach them some more, make sure they're ready for the God. Oh, and then there's also that issue of because they didn't go out, they didn't get, you know, executed.
Right.
A little detail.
Incidentally, yes.
Yeah, you almost want to put quotes on it. Those special persecutions. Exactly what did that look like?
Oh, dear. I've got to tell you, I did check out a book on the martyrs, and you don't want to do that if you have a weak stomach.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Right. You know, that whole bit I was referring to about the enemies of the kingdom, right, and the faint-hearted believers joining in with them, you know, how ugly, how dark, right, the ungodly respond to the godly.
Yes.
Keep that in mind if you actually do what I've been saying all night long of, you know, starting with that existential divine ideal of love in the nucleus of your inner life and having your whole fruits based upon that. Yeah. Think about how the ungodly will respond to you.
You know, the beauty of this statement by Matthew, especially the end here, even the less I comprehend him, the more I love him. When you think of that statement, he who has seen me has seen the Father, and you think about endless cycles of eternity in us growing in our relationship to the personality of the Universal Father, I can't help but imagine that it's going to be similar, that because of that infinite nature and that differential, the less I comprehend of the Universal Father, the more I love him. It's just going to be along those same lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just, you know, as I was just pointing out, you need to, you know, get a hold of that very firmly, because you're then going to face the facts of the world. And I was, you know, that passage I was alluding to about the enemies of the kingdom, that's, you know, in the farewell discourse in paper 180, that's section 3, how it starts out, the enmity of the world.
Yeah.
And you know, it doesn't just say independent cosmic thinking in that sentence. It says courageous and independent cosmic thinking. So, you know, all this stuff we've been talking about tonight, we want to get clear on it, but we also want to be very sober about what this does to you in your relationship to others.
Yes.
You may have, you know, a universal desire to do good, but they're going to want to do otherwise to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I was thinking about courage today and how little I've used it in my life. But there's always tomorrow or later tonight, I guess.
Yeah, well, be careful what you ask for, you know. I mean, you might want to knock wood right now or, yeah. I think, Andrew, if angels heard that.
No, I take it back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you got to be so careful. Oh,
yeah,
gosh. Well, listen,
what I was just
under.
Alluding to, but yes, be careful what you ask for.
We're under a minute, and I just wanted to remind our listeners that if you'd like to listen to this broadcast again, you can go to symmetryofsoul.org. Or you can also go to blogtalkradio.com and search for Symmetry of Soul to listen to any of our broadcasts again. Download them onto your podcasts. It's a wonderful way to listen when you're just traveling around in the car or sometimes if I'm having trouble sleeping at night. Not that Chris put you to sleep. I'm not saying that, but you know. Anyway, much love to all of you.
Take care, everyone.
God bless all.
Yep. Love you all. Bye now.